It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer-Kent. K-12 education in the U.S. is a hot-button topic with controversies over access to books and how kids are taught about racism. But the question of who is allowed to teach and lead schools with race as a central issue has been a battle since the Brown v. Board of Education ruling, which turned 68 this year. In the wake of that Supreme Court ruling and well into the 70s, many white school boards, superintendents, parents, and lawmakers starkly opposed desegregating students in schools and also the thought of black educators. Join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Leslie Fenwick is the former dean and a professor at Harvard University School of Education. She is the author of Jim Crow's Pink Slip, The Untold Story of Black Principal and Teacher Leadership, which was published by Harvard Education Press in May. Leslie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Shereen.
You explored a relatively unknown legacy of the landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision that found segregated education unconstitutional. Why is it important to examine this history?
You know, despite the documented history, there's this pervasive myth that is repeated not only in the research literature, but also kind of popularly in newspaper accounts and in our dialogue about Brown, that Blacks left the education professions to pursue new careers open to them after desegregation. But this isn't true, and this isn't what the historical record shows. What is true is that the Black educator pipeline was nearly decimated after Brown due to massive resistance to the law by white citizens and public officials. So before Brown, in the 17 states that were operating racially segregated systems, 35 to 50% of principals and teachers were Black, 35 to 50%. And today, about 7% of the nation's 3.2 million teachers are Black, and about 11% of the nation's 93,000 principals are Black, and less than 3% of the nation's nearly 14,000 superintendents are Black. And so we've gone backward, not forward. And I think part of this is a lack of acknowledgement about how we got here in the first place.
Why do you think that disparity exists in the historical record?
This is a really profound question. The primary research or primary evidentiary base for my book was a series of U.S. Senate hearings held in 1971 about the displacement of Black principals and teachers. And that 1971 date should tell your listeners that this isn't ancient history. We think of Brown as the decision coming down in 1954, but in fact, our nation's schools in those 17 dual system states really didn't desegregate in earnest until the late 1970s. Those U.S. Senate hearings, when this problem came to the ears of Congress, those U.S. Senate hearings document the displacement of Black principals and teachers and their exceptional credentials. And I too have wondered why this piece of history hasn't been told in full. I don't have a full answer for that, other than I think that it has been an oversight, deliberate or not, of scholars, historians, and journalists.
Before the Supreme Court ruling, what was education like for Black students in the United States?
So my book focuses primarily on the circumstances of the 17 dual system states, those states that said by law and by custom that Black and white students were not to be educated together. So you had separate facilities for Black and white students, and more profoundly, you had separate funding mechanisms for Black and white schools. Black schools were tremendously underfunded if they were funded at all. And so typically Black school facilities would be dilapidated. School materials would be passed from white schools to Black schools after they had been used and sometimes desecrated with racial epithets. But one difference stood out between Black and white schools that has not been acknowledged, and that is the caliber of Black principals and teachers in terms of their academic credentials, professional licensure, experience, and commitment to anti-racism, even at that time. So Black principals and teachers were more credentialed than their white peers in all segregated school settings, the all Black school settings and the all white school settings. If you compared the teaching force in the all Black school settings, you would find that Black teachers held more academic credentials than their white peers. And as an example, in my book, Jim Crow's Pink Slip, I point to Sumner High School in Kansas City, Kansas, as one example. It was not an exemplar. It was Sumner is really more reflective of the general rule. As early as 1926, the roster of Sumner faculty showed that 41% of the all-Black faculty held master's degrees, including three from the University of Chicago. And by 1935, the percentage had grown to about 61% with master's degrees, including three faculty who had earned those degrees from the University of Chicago, two from Columbia University, and one from Harvard University. And what's notable is that with integration, the school's faculty by 1968 included more faculty, and the percentage of faculty members with master's degrees fell below the 1926 level to 35%. And this is the untold story that I unpack in my book. You know, how did these Black educators at a time of deep racial constriction become more credentialed than their white peers? And what did that mean for the quality of education really being delivered in all Black segregated schools?
We're talking about how thousands of Black educators were purged from the public school system after the Supreme Court ordered schools to be segregated. With us is Howard University education professor Leslie Fenwick. Historians broadly say African American children received an inferior education in segregated schools compared to their white peers. Was that the case?
You know, when you look at this history, that would have to be challenged. Certainly, Black schools were underfunded, and that was horrific. Certainly, they were under-resourced in terms of curricular materials, and that was anti-democratic and anti-American. But the caliber of the teachers, the models of intellectual authority, and the caliber of the principals is really unparalleled. And so I'd like to unpack, Shereen, for a minute, how these Black educators earned these academic credentials and what it meant for the students they were teaching. So yes, when you looked at the tangible resources of the school, the facilities and perhaps the curricular materials and the funding, all of those things were inferior, but the caliber of the teaching force, the individuals who are delivering education to children, is exceptional. So these Black educators, both the principals and the superintendents, earned their college degrees at historically Black colleges and universities, HBCUs, because state laws at the time, prior to Brown, prohibited them from attending other institutions because those were white reserved colleges and universities. Even the public colleges and universities that Blacks supported with tax dollars. So after earning their college degrees at HBCUs, they traveled north and Midwest to earn graduate degrees, master's and doctoral degrees, because they were locked out of the white reserved public and private graduate schools. And where did the majority of these Black principals throughout the 17 dual system states, from Delaware down to Florida, over to Alabama, Arkansas, Kansas, Texas, Where did they attend graduate schools? They attended some of the nation's most preeminent institutions: New York University, Columbia University, The Ohio State University, University of Michigan, University of Chicago, University of Wisconsin,
Sure.
Kansas State, Iowa. They then returned to the South in what I call an academic migration to teach in segregated Black schools. So even though segregated Black schools were poorly funded, the teachers and principals in these buildings were highly educated, credentialed, and effective. And when you look at the data, they were more academically credentialed than their white peers in segregated all-white schools. And yet this story has not been told.
Leslie
And part
Fenwick
of the
is the
reason.
author of Jim Crow's Pink Slip and a professor at Howard University. Up ahead, what happened to Black educators who lost their jobs in the wake of the Brown decision and the economic impact on communities of color? Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Kate Archer Kent. The Supreme Court decision that ended legal segregation in American schools also led to the dismissal or demotion of tens of thousands of teachers and principals, not because they weren't qualified, but to avoid white students being taught or led by Black educators. Our discussion continues at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We're talking with author and Howard University educator Leslie Fenwick about the continuing fallout. Leslie, what happened to Black educators after the U.S. Supreme Court ordered schools to integrate?
So prior to the decision that came down in 1954, in about 1953, many of these Black educators began receiving letters from their superintendent saying that if Brown was successful, their services would no longer be needed. And certainly we know because of the historical record that Brown was successful in terms of the decision being endorsed by the Supreme Court. And Brown became the law of the land. And summarily, about 100,000 Black principals and teachers were fired, dismissed, and demoted. And at the time, the economic impact between about 1954 and 1971, the economic impact of the loss of those jobs was about a $1.1 billion economic impact on the Black community. So two things happened. Black educators were fired, dismissed, and demoted, and they were not hired into the desegregating or integrating school system. And so Brown becomes defined as racially balancing student populations when the Brown decision and the decisions subsequent to it said that our nation would not achieve integration until we had desegregated or integrated schools wholly, and wholly meant in terms of the student population, the faculty, the administrators, and other staff. And so we have this unfulfilled promise of Brown still lingering with us today.
What was the rationale that was used? I mean, the Black teachers and principals knew this was coming, but how was it presented to them?
You're right, Shereen, that Black principals and teachers knew this was coming. In fact, as early as 1952, Thurgood Marshall, who then was an NAACP attorney and later, decades later, became the nation's first Supreme Court justice who was African American, he established at the NAACP the Department of Teacher Information and Security because he and others knew that given the racial customs, some would say racial madness, and the racist and segregationist laws on the books in the northern border states and the southern states, that Black educators would lose their jobs. And so Marshall establishes this division of teacher information and security to provide funding to financially support Black principals and teachers whom he knew would lose their jobs. So that was one strategy that the NAACP began to gear up for litigation around employment discrimination to protect Black principals and teachers.
Leslie Fenwick is the Dean Emerita and Professor at Howard University's School of Education. Did teacher licensing requirements in states change then at that point?
Yes, and so the U.S. Senate hearings also show state by state that Black teachers had higher levels of licensure and there were higher percentages of Black teachers than white teachers with licensure in all Black segregated schools. And this is really, again, quite a profound finding that not only did Black educators have better academic credentials, they also had, as a group, on a near to one-to-one basis, better professional licensure statistics or credentials, rather. So after Brown, states begin to work with testing agencies to create tests that would be used as a barrier to prevent desegregating school systems from hiring Black teachers. And so the Black teachers who and principals who had kind of been purged from the system, if they attempt to apply for positions in the newly desegregating or integrating system, they're required to now pass new licensure exams. And states tinker around with cutoff scores to set cutoff scores beyond certain predicted or average performance levels for Blacks. And so these tests are used, these licensure examinations are used as a barrier. That is their history and intent. And in some states, when the plan backfired, for instance, in Florida, despite all the tinkering with the tests, Blacks continued to outperform white candidates for the job. And so then Florida drops the licensure exam and the attendant cutoff score and seeks other means for excluding Blacks from being hired into the newly desegregating and integrating school systems.
What was the economic effect on communities of color from this purge of educators that happened?
Well, so you see three effects. One, 100,000 jobs lost across the 17 northern border states and southern states that had operated racially segregated school systems. And those jobs weren't just lost, they were transferred to whites. So that's one impact. And the economic impact at the time was about $1.1 million in today's money. That would be about $2.2 billion. At the time, it was $1.1 billion in terms of economic impact across the 17 dual system states. In today's money, that would be about $2.2 billion with a B as in boy. So the loss of those jobs, Also, the inability to be hired into the newly desegregating and integrating system. So remember, with Brown, Black students are now transferred into the previously all-white segregated schools. And so there's a burgeoning student population and a demand for more principals and teachers. But Black educators are locked out of that equation, and they're not able to access the newly created jobs in the integrating and desegregating system. And so there's this ongoing economic impact, not only from being fired, dismissed, and demoted, but not from being rehired. And the third, I think, economic impact, and this is discussed in my book, are examples of men and women who had been viewed as community leaders in their schools, as principals and teachers, who were leading the establishment of NAACP chapters and leading voting rights campaigns. Now that structure for leadership has kind of been knocked out from under their feet, and they scrambled to find, you know, ways to support themselves and their families. And there's one story that's kind of very representative of many, of a former principal, an African-American male, who finds himself working in very menial factory conditions with some of his former students.
Leslie Fenwick, the author of Jim Crow's Pink Slip, stays with us. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. News update is next on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer Kent. Let's return to our conversation about the downside to the 1954 Brown v. Board of Education decision, which desegregated schools and resulted in more than 100,000 job losses for qualified black teachers, principals, and superintendents. Join in on the ongoing impact for schools and communities at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Author and Howard University educator Leslie Fenwick stays with us. Deborah from La Crosse is on the phone. Hi, Deborah.
When I was in law school, I had the privilege of meeting with Professor Derrick Bell, who was one of the original critical race theorists. He was also, he's deceased now, but he was an NAACP attorney on some of the sister cases to Brown. He's written extensively about the damage that that decision did, and he wrote that as an NAACP attorney, he and the others were forced to offer integration as the only solution, whether that was what the plaintiffs wanted or not. Actually, the plaintiffs in general did want separate and equal schools for their kids. As a substitute teacher over the last 20 years, I've seen the damage done to our students of color, particularly black students and First Nation students.
Leslie, what do you say about what Deborah had to say there, the impact that she's seeing?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Deborah. I think that Brown was a miraculous legal decision, right? It ended legal segregation in public schools. I know we still struggle with racially balancing our schools and their funding, but it was a miraculous and deeply intellectual feat to be accomplished. The problem was not the decision, I don't believe. It was the resistance to the decision, which became the law of the land. And I don't want us to lose sight of that, that had local officials, state officials, from school boards to superintendents to mayors and city councils and governors not organized around this massive resistance strategy to undo the decision, we wouldn't be in the place that we are. But Deborah is correct in this regard, that Brown never meant close all the black schools and keep open all the segregated all-white schools and push black students into previously segregated all-white schools. What it did mean in intention was that black students and white students would learn together and also would have an equality of resources supporting their public school educational experience.
We talked a little bit earlier about the effect, the financial effect that the purge of black educators had. Talk a little bit more about the long-term impact on the communities of color as a whole, if you would, please.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll focus on students first. So now we have black students integrated into previously all-white segregated schools. And we still have this segregationist hold on those previously white segregated schools. And so Black students find themselves in environments that are hostile to their intellectual and social development. And they also find themselves in deserts largely without Black models of intellectual authority and Black models of leadership authority that can protect them, that can tell them how to negotiate kind of racist structures and racism itself. And you necessarily see then an impact on Black students' academic performance. My book goes into some detail about how Black students are treated in these circumstances well beyond 1954, well into the 1970s, and some of these sentiments we still see today.
Leslie Fenwick is the author of Jim Crow's Pink Slip. It examines how the Black educational workforce was decimated in a backlash to court-ordered integration of public schools. There have been recent news reports about educators being fired for teaching so-called critical race theory. James Whitfield, for example, was dismissed from his principal position in Texas for speaking out against racism. And the Washington Post reports 160 teachers resigned or were fired for being too political during the pandemic. Is this purge of educators that grew out of Brown still occurring?
I tell this story relative to this conversation about critical race theory and public school education. In 2017, I was invited by some of the members of the class of Rhodes Scholars. And we know Rhodes Scholars to be among the nation's and the world's best and brightest college graduates. These are individuals who've graduated from college and who will go off to the University of Oxford and study for master's and doctoral degrees. Well, prior to their leaving in 2017, I gave this cohort, this particular class, a tour of the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. The Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture is the nation's third busiest museum after the Louvre and the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum. It's the third busiest museum, which tells me that the people of the nation and the world want to know the story of Black intellectual, historical, and cultural achievements. When this group met me in Heritage Hall, the large open space that greets visitors to the museum, they had a real palpable excitement about being in the museum. And as we proceeded on the tour, I saw this group of Rhodes Scholars' excitement turn to like this quizzical concern and then a soft anger. And what I remember when I spoke to this group of Rhodes Scholars about their experience at the museum, they were not angry at what they were being taught about Black history, about American history. They were angry that they had never been exposed to this information in their elementary, middle school, high school, college education. And they couldn't believe that they, as Rhodes Scholars, were going off to study for graduate degrees without knowing this history, this racially divisive history, and this racially triumphant history. And so I say that if we can teach, if certainly these Rhodes Scholars, among our nation's best and brightest young people, want and need this knowledge, certainly we as American citizens can find ways to deliver in age-appropriate ways the information about our country's history and present status.
School systems are struggling to find and retain teachers of color. You point out that nearly 40% of public school students are Black or Latino, but only 7% of the nation's more than 3 million teachers are Black. What's the solution here? How can that be fixed?
Yeah, we have this tremendous demographic mismatch between the nation's public school population and the school personnel who serve them. Even if you go in urban centers, The overwhelming majority of students are going to be students of color, and the overwhelming majority of teachers are going to be not going to be educators of color. In fact, in urban centers, about 91% of teachers are white. And if you go into inner city schools, about 73% of teachers are white. And while I'm not talking, and nor are education researchers and practitioners talking about race matching children, we do acknowledge that there is a tremendous demographic mismatch. And we have about 30 years of research, at least 30 years of research, that shows that academic and social benefits accrue to Black and Hispanic Latinx students when they're in diversely staffed schools. They're less likely to be expelled or suspended, less likely to be misplaced in special education, more likely to graduate high school in 4 years, and more likely to apply for college and be accepted to college and attend college. So these are some very important academic and social benefits that accrue to students when they are in diversely staffed schools.
So the data show that there's a direct benefit of having more diversity in the teaching staff, but how difficult is it for schools to attract those teachers of color? Is this a trickle-down effect all the way back from Brown?
The reason that I wrote Jim Crow's Pink Slip is I think that we can trace this history to the current underrepresentation of Blacks in the educator workforce. And as schools struggle, school systems all across the country are struggling to get teachers in front of students for all the reasons that we know, prime among them the pandemic and to a certain extent, a horrid school violence concerns. There are still barriers to Blacks participating fully in the educator workforce that I think we need to examine. And also, we know that there are certain institutions that are very strong engines for the production of Black teachers and other teachers of color. Today, in 2022, historically Black colleges and universities, HBCUs, produce 50% of the nation's Black teachers. And yet HBCUs are only about 3% of the nation's 4,500 institutions of higher education. And so these are strong engines for the production of Black teachers. There are two Hispanic serving institutions, one in Texas and one in Florida, that produce over 90% of the nation's Hispanic Latinx teachers. And so I think that there's a way to continue to diversify the educator workforce by providing more resources to those institutions that are strong engines for the productions of teachers of color, and also shoring up institutions that haven't really been able to carry their weight on this issue.
Leslie Fenwick is the author of Jim Crow's Pink Slip, The Untold Story of Black Principal and Teacher Leadership. Fenwick is a professor and dean emerita at Howard University's School of Education. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Kate Archer-Kent. More than 100,000 Black educators lost their jobs in the wake of the Supreme Court Brown decision. And today's schools continue to struggle finding and keeping teachers and administrators of color. Join in with your thoughts and questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Leslie Fenwick, author of Jim Crow's Pink Slip, is with us for about 10 more minutes. We have a caller. Roosevelt is here from Milwaukee. Roosevelt, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great. How are you? Thanks for calling.
Hi. So I had a comment. I wanted to thank the author for the book. First of all, I didn't know this book existed. I heard it in the car, so I do plan on getting it and reading it. But I wanted to also confirm what she said about the importance of Black educators being represented in the education system for children. Really quick, and I hope I don't ramble and skip my other point, but I had a conversation with my daughter about integration and segregation and how that unfolded and the consequences of both of those approaches as far as education in our country. And I had a painting that my daughter made for me of Kwame Ture, formerly Stokely Carmichael, in my office. And so one of the a student of mine asked me about the painting. I explained who that gentleman was and what why he was important to African-American history. And so the student asked me, why do we not know about this? And so I just wanted to just confirm what the author said about the importance of Black representation in education to speak to children, as she already mentioned, to help them navigate racism, other issues in school building, power issues, et cetera. And just confirm that. And I wanted to thank her for the book, which I do plan on reading. A fascinating conversation.
Thank you, Roosevelt. Leslie, what do you have to say about what Roosevelt said?
Thank you, Roosevelt. You know, this generation of young people, I would say, I'm talking about those who are under the age of 25, are the country's most racially, ethnically, and linguistically diverse that we've seen. And while many of us who are older than 25, certainly those of us who are older than 50, we were raised in a more in a society that was more binary in its assumptions: white, Black, straight, gay, American, not American, Western, Eastern. Younger individuals, I think, are primed for the truth about our nation's racially divisive and racially triumphant history. They're more intersectional. They are living with more diversities, if you will. And I think in many ways, they're more accepting of more diversities, and they want to know this information. It's edifying to them to know the full story of our history. And so I think that Roosevelt's daughter and students are reflective of this generation, which is now one of the largest generations that our nation has seen. It was the baby boomers, but we're being replaced in terms of numbers and diversity by these younger generations.
We're talking with Leslie Fenwick about the backlash against Black educators that occurred after the Supreme Court ordered public schools to integrate 68 years ago. What does the data tell us about the lack of diverse teachers and its impact on white students?
You know, there are a series of reports that have been summarized by the National Bureau for Economic Research. The most recent was conducted by a group of researchers at Johns Hopkins, American University, and several other universities, speaking to the academic and social benefits that accrue not only to Black and Hispanic students when they're in diversely staffed schools, but also looking at research from white students when they have Black and other educators of color. And one of the new findings is that white students report that they find Black teachers more caring. And I think that's a very interesting finding. And I think we need to do more research about white students' experience with Black teachers and the benefits that accrue to them. Again, I think we have to be very careful about not suggesting and encouraging the race matching of students. This research that is being conducted and reported really speaks to the value all around for having a diverse educator workforce, its impact on students. And I think that's what's promising about the research.
There's an ongoing debate and backlash in schools around the country regarding critical race theory. What echoes do you see in this debate from the backlash that occurred after the Brown decision?
What's really remarkable to me, having read this history in great depth and written about it in Jim Crow's Pink Slip, is that the same strategies are being used, the exact same script, the physical intimidation of school board members, the threatening to burn books, the rallying of state legislators and legislatures and governors to the divisive calls. It's the exact same script. And so one of the things that history teaches us is that in many ways, history isn't dead. It's still living. Not only are we living with the ripple effects of unresolved racial issues, we can see the same scripts and strategies being used largely to create divisiveness and I think work against unity and a productive new future.
We have about a minute left, and a caller could not stay with us, but wanted to know if you have any information about how Black people in other professions were affected by this history.
Yes, you know, there are several other books looking at how government employees, Black government employees, were affected when the federal workforce was resegregated. And what's fascinating about these other pieces of research is that here again, you see this common thread that Blacks were performing at or above the levels of their white colleagues and still captured by the arc of race madness. I think one solution is represented in my book by the history, and that is the NAACP led the Herculean effort to craft Brown, to do the litigation, to support Black teachers, defend Black teachers and principals. And they had partners that were very active. The National Association of Secondary School Principals had primarily been an all-white male organization. And yet with this issue, the National Association for Secondary School Principals worked with the NAACP in this cross-racial support of Black educators and principals, Black teachers and principals.
Leslie, thank you so much for joining us. This has been fascinating.
Thank you so much, Shireen.
Leslie Fenwick is the Dean Emerita and Professor at Howard University's School of Education. She is the author of Jim Crow's Pink Slip, The Untold Story of Black Principal and Teacher Leadership. I'm Shireen Seward, in for Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.